Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner with 60 minutes of news, information, commentary, and history about the African American community. This week I have readings from the Journal of Blacks in Higher Education, the New York Times, the Oklahoman newspaper. I'm wrapping up with two selections from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper, and I'm starting with this. Lincoln University receives record $25 million donation from Mackenzie Scott. This appeared in the Philadelphia Tribune newspaper and its PhillyTrib.com website on December 8, 2025, and was written by Chanel Hill. Lincoln University has received a $25 million gift from philanthropist Mackenzie Scott, marking only the second unrestricted donation in the university's history. The gift will support scholarships, programs, and initiatives for students, faculty, and staff, and will serve as the foundation for a larger campaign focused on student success. Scott previously gave Lincoln $20 million in 2020, which at the time was the largest single contribution in the university's history. Founded in 1854, Lincoln University is the nation's first degree-granting HBCU. Located in Oxford, Pennsylvania, in southern Chester County, the university enrolls more than 1,600 students and offers over 34 programs. Lincoln University was founded to break barriers and create pathways for African Americans to thrive, said Lincoln President Brenda A. Allen in a statement. This investment honors the legacy and propels us forward, enabling us to build on 171 years of excellence and innovation, she added. It is a powerful affirmation to the enduring value of historically black colleges and universities. Lincoln alumni praised the gift, emphasizing its immediate impact on students. Mackenzie Hanks, a recent graduate now attending George Washington University, recalled a time when the university helped her navigate delayed funding. "I once had a situation where I couldn't pay a bill on time, and the school helped me by removing a hold on my account and making accommodations," she said. "I've seen how Lincoln always puts money back into its students. I'm confident this gift will be no different. Because it's unrestricted, the university can invest in students in the ways they need most." Drake Smith, a recent graduate now attending Yale Divinity School, highlighted the donation as recognition of Lincoln's legacy and Allen's leadership. "Lincoln is the genesis of black higher education," he said. "Walking on campus, you can feel its history, the struggles and the successes. It began with just one building and a handful of students, and has grown into a top 20 HBCU and leading liberal arts coeducational university." This donation also reflects President Allen's leadership through the pandemic, political challenges, and important university improvements. "Mackenzie Scott wouldn't give millions twice without believing in that leadership," he added. Lincoln is one of many HBCUs benefiting from Scott's ongoing philanthropy. In 2019, she pledged to give away most of her wealth during her lifetime, which Bloomberg estimates at $40.1 billion. Since then, she has donated more than $19 billion to nonprofits, educational institutions, and community organizations. This year alone, Scott has donated $80 million to Howard University, $63 million each to Prairie View A&M and North Carolina A&T, $50 million each to Bowie State, Norfolk State, and Winston-Salem State Universities, and $38 million each to Spelman and Xavier Universities. Dillard University received $19 million. She also donated $70 million to the United Negro College Fund, strengthening the long-term financial health of its 37 private member HBCUs. "This extraordinary gift is a powerful vote of confidence in HBCUs and in the work of UNCF," said United Negro College Fund President and CEO Michael Lomax in a statement. "It provides a once-in-a-generation opportunity for our member institutions to build permanent assets that will support students and campuses for decades to come." Smith praised Scott's generosity and encouraged broader support for HBCUs. "You don't have to be a multibillionaire or millionaire to give," he said. HBCUs need donations from everyone. Her support is especially meaningful at a time when funding for minority-serving institutions is under pressure. The broader impact of HBCUs is significant. They have produced 80% of all black judges, 50% of all black doctors, 50% of all black teachers, and 40% of all black engineers. According to a 2024 UNCF report, historically black colleges and universities generate $16.5 billion in direct economic impact nationwide and support over 136,000 jobs. There are 107 HBCUs in the United States. Lincoln University has played a pivotal role in that legacy. Hanks credits the university for shaping her into the person she is today. "Attending Lincoln was one of the best decisions I've ever made," she said. "Lincoln shapes you. It doesn't break you. It makes you a better person. I wouldn't be where I am today without them," she added. "Even now, I continue to learn from alumni and mentors I meet there. Lincoln still pours into me as if I were still a student. I love Lincoln forever." That was the article titled, "Lincoln University Receives Record $25 Million Donation from Mackenzie Scott." This appeared in the Philadelphia Tribune newspaper on December 8, 2025, and was written by Chanel Hill. My next selection is titled, "The 2025 Recipients of Harvard's W.E.B. Du Bois Medal." This was published in the Journal of Blacks in Higher Education at its jbhe.com website and written by that journal's editors. It was published November 21st, 2025. The Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard University recently announced the 7 recipients of the 2025 W.E.B. Du Bois Medal. The prestigious award is presented annually to individuals in the United States and around the world in recognition of their contributions to African and African American culture and the life of the mind. The recipients are James E. Clyburn, the United States Representative for South Carolina's 6th Congressional District. He has been in office since 1993 and is currently serving in his 17th consecutive term. Over the course of his career, he has held several prominent leadership roles within the Democratic Party, including Assistant Democratic Leader from 2011 to 2018 and 2023 to 2024, and House Majority Whip from 2019 to 2022 and 2007 to 2010, making him the first African American to serve multiple terms as Majority Whip. Currently, he serves as the ranking member of the Appropriations Committee Subcommittee on Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development. A graduate of historically black South Carolina State University, Congressman Clyburn has also led several efforts to preserve and restore historic buildings on HBCU campuses. Misty Copeland. Misty Copeland is a prominent American ballet dancer and author. Born in Kansas City, Missouri, and raised in San Pedro, California, Copeland is the first ever black woman principal dancer at the American Ballet Theater. In addition to her work as a performer, she previously served as a member of the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition during President Obama's second term. Copeland has launched her own philanthropic foundation, an athletic wear business, and a production company. She has authored several books, including her memoir, Life in Motion, An Unlikely Ballerina, published by Touchstone in 2014. For her contributions to ballet and diversifying the art form, the University of Hartford awarded Copeland an honorary doctorate in 2014. Marielle Franco, a Brazilian politician and human rights activist, received her W.E.B. Du Bois Medal posthumously. Born in Rio de Janeiro in 1979, Franco attended the Pontifical Catholic University of Rio after giving birth to her daughter at age 19. As a single mother, she went on to receive her bachelor's degree in social sciences, and later, her master's degree in public administration from Fluminense Federal University. Among many other causes, Franco was particularly outspoken against police brutality. While driving home after speaking at a political event titled Young Black Women Moving Structures, Franco was shot 4 times in the head and killed by 2 unknown attackers on March 14, 2018. Brittany Griner. Brittany Griner is an activist, 3-time Olympic gold medalist, and a professional basketball player with the Atlanta Dream of the Women's National Basketball Association. On February 17, 2022, Griner was detained and arrested by Russian Customs after officials found vape cartridges with hashish oil in her luggage. Although she was legally authorized to use medicinal cannabis in her then home state of Arizona, the substance is illegal in Russia, causing Griner to face a 10-year sentence in a Russian penal colony. She was released on December 8, 2022 in a prisoner exchange. In addition to her work as an activist for the LGBT community, Griner now advocates for the return of other Americans detained in foreign countries. She has published 2 memoirs, In My Skin, My Life on and Off the Basketball Court, published by Day Street Books in 2014, and Coming Home, published by Knopf in 2024. George E. Johnson. George E. Johnson is the founder of Johnson Products, a cosmetics manufacturing company known for creating hair care products tailored for African Americans. The company was founded in 1954 with its first product, Ultra Wave, a hair relaxer for men. 3 years later, Johnson Products released Ultra Sheen, a hair straightener for women. Over the next few decades, the company expanded its product line and developed cosmetologist training courses for proper use of its products. In 1971, Johnson Products became the first African-American-owned company listed on the American Stock Exchange. That same year, Johnson became the first African-American to serve on the board of directors of Commonwealth Edison. Spike Lee. Spike Lee is an American filmmaker whose work explores themes of race relations and black culture. Some of his most notable films include Malcolm X, released in 1992, Do the Right Thing, released in 1989, which received an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Screenplay, and BlacKkKlansman, released in 2018, which won the Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. His most recent film, Highest to Lowest, was released earlier this year. Lee is an HBCU graduate, having earned his bachelor's degree in mass communication from Morehouse College. He also took film courses at historically black Clark Atlanta University. Later, he received a Master of Fine Arts degree in film and television from New York University. Amy Sherald. Amy Sherald is an activist and artist who primarily works as a portraitist documenting the contemporary African-American experience in the United States. Among her many notable works are an official commission from First Lady Michelle Obama to paint her portrait for the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. Sherald's art is held in numerous museums around the world, such as the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture and the Embassy of the United States in Dakar, Senegal. Sherald earned her bachelor's degree in painting from historically black Clark Atlanta University and her Master of Fine Arts degree in painting from the Maryland Institute College of Art. That was the article titled, The 2025 Recipients of Harvard's W.E.B. Du Bois Medal. It was published in the Journal of Blacks in Higher Education at its website, jbhe.com, on November 21, 2025, and it was written by that journal's editorial staff. My next reading on today's African American Hour is an obituary from the pages of the New York Times newspaper. The title is Viola Fletcher, 111, oldest survivor of Tulsa Race Massacre is dead. This was written by Alex Traub and was published Wednesday, November 26, 2025. Viola Fletcher, who as a child in 1921 saw her affluent black neighborhood in Oklahoma torched by white citizens in what became known as the Tulsa Race Massacre, one of the most violent acts of racial violence in American history, and who, a century later, testified in Congress to the terror she witnessed in the hope of winning reparations, died on Monday, November 24th, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She was 111 and the oldest survivor of the attack. Her death in a hospital was confirmed by Tiffany Crutcher, a close family friend. Her death leaves just one surviving witness to the massacre, Leslie Randall, who was also 111, 6 months younger than Miss Fletcher. The Greenwood neighborhood in Tulsa, Oklahoma, home to about 10,000 people in the early 20th century, became known colloquially as Black Wall Street for the successful entrepreneurship of its residents and the prosperity of the many families who lived there. The neighborhood was destroyed in the massacre, which led to as many as 300 deaths and mass homelessness. Miss Fletcher grew up as a working-class resident of Greenwood. Her stepfather, Henry Ellis, held several jobs at once, from breaking in horses to selling clothes. Viola went to school in Greenwood and attended Wednesday night and Sunday services at a Baptist church. She remembered watching Greenwood men gather to make homemade ice cream on special occasions while women prepared pies and layer cakes. Early on the morning of June 1st, 1921, Viola woke up to a banging sound. She thought it was someone beating a rug, she said, until her mother hollered for her to get out of bed immediately. The day before, word had spread in Tulsa that a 19-year-old black shoe shiner, Dick Rowland, had attempted to rape a 17-year-old white elevator operator, Sarah Page, in the building where she worked. Miss Page later denied that Mr. Rowland had done anything wrong, and the case was dropped. But by then, inflamed by the rumors, many of Tulsa's white citizens were already set on imposing their own idea of justice. Hundreds of heavily armed white men gathered outside the courthouse where Mr. Rowland was being held. Soon, armed black veterans of World War I arrived as well, seeking to prevent a lynching. A scuffle ensued and a shot was fired. The next morning, the assault began. Over 16 hours, nearly 3 dozen blocks of Greenwood were looted and set ablaze. More than 1,000 homes were destroyed, as were almost all of the district's black-owned businesses. The theaters, restaurants, hotels, barbershops, and offices of doctors and lawyers and real estate brokers, according to a 2001 report by an Oklahoma commission that had examined the onslaught. In December 1921, the American Red Cross determined that close to the entire population of the neighborhood had become homeless. There is still no consensus about the death toll. The Red Cross put it at 55 to 300 people. Viola's family fled in a horse and buggy. As they were leaving Tulsa, she recalled, she saw ash falling on the streets, reminding her of snow. She also saw, as other witnesses did, an airplane dropping what looked like firebombs. She passed piles of corpses. She saw a white man blow off a black man's head with a shotgun, she said. Nobody was held legally responsible for the destruction and deaths. In the years after, the Tulsa Massacre was not widely taught in American history classes. In Tulsa itself, memory was suppressed. Police records vanished, newspaper archives were tampered with, and victims were buried in unmarked graves. Some residents reached adulthood unaware that the massacre had happened. But its 100th anniversary in 1921 brought it renewed attention, coming a year after the murder of George Floyd, a black man, by a white Minneapolis police officer, had sparked nationwide protests. By then, Miss Fletcher, a retired maid, was just one of three remaining survivors. The two others were her brother, Hughes Ellis, then 100, and Miss Randall, then 106. They began telling their stories to national media outlets, testified before Congress, and also joined a lawsuit demanding reparations. With the help of a grandson, Ike Howard, Miss Fletcher wrote a memoir, Don't Let Them Bury My Story, the oldest living survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre in her own words, published in 2023. The neighborhood I fell asleep in that night was rich, not just in terms of wealth, but in culture, community, heritage. Ms. Fletcher told a House Judiciary Subcommittee in May 2021 as it considered reparations for the survivors and their descendants. Within a few hours, all that was gone. Viola Fletcher was born on May 5, 1914 in rural Comanche County, Oklahoma. Her parents, Lucinda and John Wesley Ford, were sharecroppers who divorced not long after her birth. Her mother married Henry Ellis, and the couple, along with Lucinda's children, moved to Greenwood, where Mr. Ellis built the family a home. The family's flight from the massacre concluded 30 miles northeast of Tulsa in a wooded area called Claremore, where they found safety living in a tent. The women went to the bathroom in the woods, three at a time for safety. The family used sticks, string, and rocks to catch rabbits for food. They trapped lightning bugs in a jar for light at night. Viola never received more than an elementary school education. Instead, she worked alongside her relatives as a sharecropper, picking cotton and tending to livestock for a dollar a day. In 1929, while her family was traveling in search of work, Viola ran into a school friend from Greenwood. "It was one of the happiest moments I'd experienced since our escape from the catastrophe," Miss Fletcher recalled in her memoir. "We both wanted to know if either had seen any of the other boys and girls from our school, but we were the first and only ones both of us had seen in 8 long years. As an adult, Miss Fletcher spent most of her life working as a maid for white families in Bartlesville, a town north of Tulsa. As she washed their dishes and tucked their little ones into bed, the journalist Wesley Lowry wrote in a 2023 profile of Miss Fletcher for the Washington Post, she wondered whether they were among those responsible, yet never held accountable for her own childhood's destruction. She married Robert Fletcher, and they had a son, Ronald. The family lived in Los Angeles, where Miss Fletcher worked in a shipyard during World War II. She left Mr. Fletcher when he became physically abusive, she wrote in her memoir. From a relationship with Larry Anderson, she had a son, James Ford, and from a relationship with Alzina Stein, she had a daughter, Deborah Ford. She raised her children as a single mother. She is survived by her son, Ronald Fletcher, and many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. In 2020, the local news media in Oklahoma wrote about Miss Fletcher's 106th birthday. The story caught the attention of a lawyer, Demario Solomon Simmons, who had long been interested in finding legal redress for victims of the massacre. He became her lawyer. Their lawsuit demanding reparations was dismissed by a district court judge in the Oklahoma Supreme Court. In 2025, Monroe Nichols, Tulsa's first black mayor, announced that the city itself would seek to fund reparations by forming a private trust tasked with raising $105 million by 2026, the 105th anniversary of the attack. In 2021, to honor the centennial, Ms. Fletcher met President Joseph R. Biden in Tulsa. A year later, she, her brother Hughes, and Ms. Randall split a $1 million donation from the entrepreneur and philanthropist Ed Mitson. Hughes Ellis died in 2023. From the night of the massacre onward, Ms. Fletcher was never again able to sleep comfortably in a bed, she wrote in her memoir. She preferred a chair with the light on. "When I sleep, it is never very deep or for very long because of the anxiety and the things I see," she wrote. "Imagine having the same horrible nightmare every night for 100 years. She found some healing during the massacre's centennial when Michael Thompson, the co-founder of a social media company called Our Black Truth, asked her if there was something she had always wanted but never had. Without hesitation, she blurted out that she wanted to go to Africa and meet real live African people. A few months later, at 107 years old, she and her brother traveled to Ghana. Somehow, she wrote of the trip, it has made me feel more whole and sure of my belonging in this life and on this planet. Along with this obituary are four black and white images. One is a 1923 photograph. It was taken from a high point, overlooking blocks of the smoldering Greenwood neighborhood that was attacked. Two others show Ms. Fletcher testifying before a House Judiciary Subcommittee in May 2021. And the final image is the cover of her memoir, Don't Let Them Bury My Story, that has a picture of Miss Fletcher in her 30s. That was the obituary titled Viola Fletcher, 111, oldest survivor of Tulsa, Oklahoma race massacre is dead. This was written by Alex Traub and published in the New York Times newspaper on Wednesday, November 26, 2025. Less than a week before the Tulsa race massacre happened in 1921, the Osage Reign of Terror began, which was a series of murders of members of the Osage tribe. This next reading connects the two events. It's titled, Parallel Tragedies, Killers of the Flower Moon, Tulsa Race Massacre Started 3 Days Apart. This was written by Nate Shute and published October 19, 2023 in the Oklahoman newspaper at its oklahoman.com website. With the cinematic release of Killers of the Flower Moon this week, history buffs are brushing up on the true events depicted in the film. One of those events was another historical massacre taking place 50 miles away. The blockbuster Martin Scorsese film, Killers of the Flower Moon, depicts the true events in 1920s Oklahoma when members of the Osage Nation were systematically killed by non-native residents seeking the tribe's oil rights. One of the earliest victims of these murders was found on May 27, 1921, on the Osage lands in northern Oklahoma. 3 days later, the Tulsa Race Massacre began. The two-day riot, brought on by white supremacists, is now considered one of the worst incidents in racial violence in American history. Both sets of tragedies put a spotlight on white people using violence in Oklahoma to seize wealth owned by minority populations. The discovery of oil in the Osage Nation's reservation gave the group a key to growing wealth, but oil was also found closer to Tulsa at Glen Pool in 1905. This spurred the growth of the city as people of all backgrounds came to the area in search of wealth. According to the Oklahoma Historical Society, Tulsa served as the base for over 400 petroleum companies by 1920, earning the moniker the Oil Capital of the World. Oklahoma was known for having strict Jim Crow laws after becoming a state, limiting the mobility of black residents. Because of this, a section of land in Tulsa, bought by O.W. Gurley, became a thriving area for black business owners, creating what is now known as Greenwood, one of the wealthiest black communities in the country. In May 1921, the Osage Reign of Terror began as Osage headright holders began dying through suspicious circumstances. Historians attribute the murders to the greed of men attempting to obtain the Osage's valuable property and mineral rights allotted them from the oil boom. On May 27, 1921, the body of Anna Brown was discovered in a rural ravine, which was the same day her cousin, Charles Whitehorn, was found dead after he had been shot between the eyes in another part of Osage County. These murders are some of the first federal investigators looked into. 3 days later, the Tulsa Race Massacre began on May 30th, after Dick Rowland, a black teenager, was accused of assaulting Sarah Page, a white woman. He fled home to Greenwood and was later arrested, but never charged with a crime. Newspaper columns in the next day's newspapers called for the teenager to be lynched, spurring a white mob to demand Rowland to be released. A group of black men arrived to assist law enforcement, but fighting between the two groups began, leading to the bloody conflict in Black Wall Street. As many as 300 people are believed to have died in the Tulsa Race Massacre. Businesses and homes were looted and property damaged at a cost estimated at $1.5 million, which is close to $37 million today. The film depicts Osage County residents watching newsreel footage of the Tulsa tragedy at the time and makes other glancing mentions to the massacre. In Osage County, 60 people were murdered between 1921 and 1925. Several Osage were either shot, poisoned, or in the case of Rita Smith, bombed. While some cases went to trial and saw convictions, both tragedies possessed several cases that have yet to hold the perpetrator accountable. 11 years after filing a lawsuit, the Osage Nation reached a settlement with the federal government in 2011 over the United States accounting and management of the tribe's trust funds and non-monetary trust assets. The $380 million awarded was divided between those who own head rights or shares of the tribe's subsurface mineral estate that lies beneath all of oil-rich Osage County. As part of the settlement, new rules for leasing oil and gas owned by the Osage were instituted, and non-Osage are prohibited from inheriting head rights. While the settlement was not reparations for the murders, the settlement is a gesture that survivors of the Tulsa Race Massacre have yet to receive. That was the newspaper article titled, "Killers of the Flower Moon, Tulsa Race Massacre Started 3 Days Apart." It was written by Nate Shute and published in the Oklahoman newspaper on October 19th, 2023. Next, a reading about fashion. This is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper, and it's titled, "How Young Black Men Are Making the Quarter-Zip Sweater Cool Again." This was written by Ernie Suggs and published Sunday, December 14, 2025. The quarter-zip sweater, long the unofficial uniform of suburban dads, middle managers, and golf course bros, has found an unlikely new champion, young black men. Thanks to TikTok, what started as a playful video that mocked knits zipped to the chin with a fresh matcha latte in hand has quickly taken on the shape of a cultural movement. It began innocently enough about 3 weeks ago when 21-year-old Jason Giamfi, capital G-Y-A-M-F-I, wearing a navy blue sweater, boldly announced that he had abandoned his trusty Nike Tech sweatsuits in favor of the quarter zip. "I don't do that Nike Tech stuff that y'all little boys do," he said in the viral post. "I'm elegant. I'm classy. Feel me. You can take me somewhere. I look presentable." As with the unpredictability and volatility of social media, the post exploded. It has garnered more than 3.5 million views and spawned a legion of imitators. From college campuses to playgrounds to shopping malls, young black and Hispanic men across the country have posted videos declaring their switch to the quarter zip. T-Pain, looking like a high school music teacher in a dark blue sweater, even got involved in the fun, posting on Instagram, 401k and a quarter zip. To many, the quarter zip has long been seen as a harmless sweater that can be casual or dressy. It is a collared pullover that zips partway down the chest. Most men wear it over a button-down, sometimes with a tie. Khakis or a nice pair of jeans are the go-to pants, along with loafers. They are viewed as clean and preppy, representing a phase of maturity most often associated with older white men as a symbol of middle-class conformity and adulthood. On the flip side, Nike Techs, the flowing and bold athletic fleece sets, are closely tied to street culture, basketball, youth fashion, and blackness. Financially, the upgrade from the $100 Nike Techs to a $25 quarter zip also makes practical sense, which is why Giamfi told the New York Times, "I really got tired of wearing the Nike Tech. After a certain point, when that frontal lobe starts developing, you're like, why am I still wearing it?" For some, the appeal of the quarter zip isn't new at all. Kalfani A. Lawson, the assistant director of International Student and Scholar Services at Georgia State University, remembers picking them up in 2011 when he scored an internship doing an archival project at the King Center. "I was looking to make a great first impression," Lawson said, adding that he purchased 2 sweaters from J. Crew. "They allowed me to exude confidence, make a great first impression, and were two staples of my wardrobe at the time that I'll always remember. He laughed about the fact that he wishes he still had those originals, even though he has replaced them twice over. "I'm in absolute love with this trend," Lawson said, adding that few groups wear it better than black male college administrators, who he said have the quarter-zip game on lock. "If trends are what these babies need to change how they present themselves and the things they engage in, then more of this, please," said Ashley Mohammed, a style consultant and founder of Be Iconic Frames. BEEYECONIC. "I love what the quarter-zip trend represents and how it makes our beautiful boys look. Celebrity stylist and designer Brian Joel called the trend fun, but said it might just be history repeating itself. He recalled past Atlanta trends where black men dressed preppy while rocking Ralph Lauren and boat shoes. He has also noticed, while shopping, that stores are subtly displaying quarter zips more prominently. This is probably a quick era of the preppy look," Joel said. "You can't forecast something like this. It gets trendy and it kinds of pops. But what started out as a sly inside joke about a declaration of manhood has also evolved into a cultural discussion about how black men should present themselves, especially in today's political, cultural, and financial climate. Call it the politics of respectability, a term coined by Harvard University scholar Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham in her 1993 book, Righteous Discontent, The Women's Movement in the Black Baptist Church, 1880 to 1920. According to Higginbotham, respectability emphasizes reform of individual behavior and attitudes both as a goal in itself and as a strategy for the reform of the entire structural system of American race relations. That is why civil rights activists, protesters, and freedom riders wore suits and ties to marches, even when they knew they faced physical danger, to present themselves as respectable. Respectability politics is also the process by which privileged members of marginalized groups align themselves with the social norms of dominant groups to advance their own position. In that sense, the trend, while signaling maturity and aspiration, also pushes back against stereotypes surrounding how black men look and dress. Still, Giamfi is careful not to oversell what a sweater can do. "I don't think necessarily there's a difference between wearing a Nike Tech or a quarter zip because the clothes don't make the man," he told the New York Times. "The man makes the clothes." That was the article titled, "How Young Black Men Are Making the Quarter Zip Sweater Cool." This was written by Ernie Suggs and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on Sunday, December 14th, 2025. On December 31st, 2025, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper stopped producing a print edition and it went all digital. This story is the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reflecting upon itself and how it deals with being a publication in a city with a large black population. This reading selection is part of a series titled Turning the Page, The Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Digital Future. The title of this specific story is Atlanta Journal-Constitution Confronts the Past and Looks to Its Future with Black Atlanta. This was published Sunday, December 21st, 2025, and written by Ernie Suggs. On the morning of March 23rd, 2023, staff members at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution were summoned to a hastily called mandatory meeting. Some crowded into a conference room, others logged in by video. Kevin Riley, the paper's editor for 12 years, was there to make official what many had already suspected. He was retiring. What followed was not expected. Andrew Morse, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's president and publisher, told the staff that there would be no interim editor and no prolonged national search, The decision, he said, had already been made. Leroy Chapman, a managing editor who had been at the paper since 2011, would take the helm. The room fell silent, then erupted in gasps, applause, and tears. Chapman, who had overseen coverage of some of Georgia's most consequential stories, including efforts to overturn the state's 2020 election, had just become the first black top editor in the newspaper's 155-year history. That moment was one of those things you can't really prepare for, he said in an interview. I didn't realize in that moment just how affirming it would be, not only for black journalists, but for a city like Atlanta that defines itself by inclusion and diversity. Atlanta has long been the place where, if you're black, talented, and ambitious, you can get a fair shot. Inside the newsroom, the celebration landed as both a milestone and a mirror reflecting how far the paper had come and how contested its relationship with black Atlanta had long been. That history takes on fresh urgency now as the Atlanta Journal-Constitution prepares to sunset its print edition at the end of the year. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Moore says, is evolving into a modern media company and redefining local news. It is doing it in a national moment where diversity and inclusion are being attacked. The newspaper is reassessing what it meant to black readers, how it has covered race, and how the slow work of hiring black journalists, from Harmon Perry in 1968 to a new generation of storytellers, has shaped its credibility. For much of their existence, Atlanta's daily newspapers reflected a social order enforced by Reconstruction and Jim Crow. The Atlanta Journal and the Atlanta Constitution of that era, long before they merged into the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, were white institutions built to serve white readers. In the late 19th and early 20th century, Henry Grady and other editors helped to shape a New South narrative that promised economic modernization while openly defending the racial order. Through the Jim Crow era, the papers largely reinforced segregation by writing about black Atlantans through a lens of crime, paternalism, or invisibility. That dynamic did not fully shift during the civil rights movement, but it did evolve. As Gene Roberts and Hank Klinkbanoff, K-L-I-B-A-N-O-F-F, document in The Race Beat, the Pulitzer Prize-winning history of news coverage of civil rights, the Constitution distinguished itself from other Southern papers by adopting a more moderate editorial stance and by acknowledging, often cautiously, that segregation's foundation was cracking. Klinkbanoff, a former managing editor at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, said that under Ralph McGill, the paper broke the Southern taboo against speaking frankly about racial violence. He wrote moral arguments against segregation that other white editors refused to touch, even if he stopped short of endorsing the movement's goals outright. In excerpts from The Race Beat in 1938, in his first directive as executive editor of the Atlanta Constitution, McGill declared that henceforth the word Negro would be capitalized whenever it was used. Klinkbanoff, said McGill, may have been the first editor in the South to abandon the common practice among journalists of the region of writing the word in a lowercase n. Former Atlanta Journal-Constitution editorial page editor Cynthia Tucker, a native of Alabama, said McGill's reputation traveled far beyond Atlanta and mattered deeply to black readers who were accustomed to far harsher treatment from the white press. If you read his columns today, they can seem tepid, but for that time and place, they were courageous. He was calling out segregationist figures when many others wouldn't, Tucker said. Ralph McGill's willingness to treat black people with a degree of civility earned the Constitution a lot of trust among black readers. McGill's protege, Eugene Patterson, authored the blistering 1963 editorial, A Flower for the Graves, after the Birmingham church bombing and read it that night on national television. Their work helped to set a moderate regional tone, showing that a white Southern daily could report honestly without being torn apart by readers or advertisers. Yet, Even as the Constitution gained national praise for its editorials, the reporters who filled the daily news columns remained almost entirely white. The Constitution did publish a weekly section put together by educator Claude George called News of Our Negro Community and covered the civil rights movement, but it largely failed to cover the lives of the black majority in Atlanta. It quoted Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Abernathy on its pages, but rarely chronicled the lives of the everyday people those men represented. That gap grew more glaring as Atlanta's black population surged and racial change accelerated. Black families and businesses were far more likely to appear in the black-owned Atlanta Daily World than in the pages of the Journal or Constitution. It wasn't until 1968, in the wake of urban uprisings the presidentially appointed Kerner Commission concluded were the results of systemic racism, that the Atlanta Journal hired its first black reporter, Harmon Perry. Perry came from the Atlanta Daily World, where he had already earned trust in neighborhoods the journal often struggled to cover. His hiring signaled that the paper was beginning, however tentatively, to reckon with the city's demographic and political realities. His first assignment was covering King's funeral. To his daughters, the first was both history and something more ordinary. I remember him being excited about getting the position because he felt like he had gone as far as he could with the Atlanta Daily World, his oldest daughter, Philippa Elder, said in an interview. And he kind of considered himself a little trailblazer. And he was. In 1988, 20 years after Perry was hired, his youngest daughter, Phyllis Perry, joined the Atlanta Journal on the copy desk and later rose to Cobb County Bureau Chief. Phyllis Perry said her father's hiring still reads as a door opening, even if he never seemed to embrace the symbolism in the way others did. The mere fact that he was doing what he was doing opened the door for me, she said. But he never wrote anything about that, period. I'm not sure it meant that much to him. But Pete Scott, who followed Perry to the Journal in 1971 as a general assignment reporter, noted those early days could be rough. He remembers a staff meeting that he and Perry attended, where an editor whose name long escaped him noted, perhaps as a joke, that the paper now had two black people. I don't know if he said black, but he said, "We had two of them," or "y'all," or something like that, Scott recalls the editor saying. "One of you is gonna fill out the quota, and the other one is gonna be the token." A photojournalist at heart, Perry stayed at the Atlanta Journal for only 5 years. In 1973, he resigned to become the Atlanta Bureau Chief for Jet Magazine. Scott stuck around until 2005, retiring after 34 years, one of the longest tenures ever for a black reporter. "I worked from about 9 in the morning to about 11 at night every night. I never left if I had an assignment," Scott said. "I did a lot of trailblazing stuff for the paper that it didn't necessarily get credit for, but I was a pretty good reporter." Although Perry's and Scott's hirings cracked open the door, it took years before a sustained team of black journalists emerged. In 1971, Tina McElroy Anza joined the Constitution as an editorial assistant before becoming a reporter, becoming the first black woman to enter the newsroom. She died last year. In 1972, the Journal hired Chet Fuller, who spent 26 years as one of the most influential voices in the newsroom, covering politics and neighborhoods before later becoming a columnist and eventually assistant managing editor. "When I describe those newsrooms to students, it might as well be Reconstruction," said Tucker, who was hired by the Atlanta Journal right out of Auburn University in 1976. "It wasn't hostile, but it could be awkward. But if I didn't know something, I'd ask. People were generally helpful." As the newspapers slowly began to diversify their newsrooms, Atlanta itself was undergoing a political transformation. In 1972, Andrew Young was elected the first black congressman from the South since Reconstruction. The following year, Maynard Jackson became Atlanta's first black mayor. One of the reporters who arrived as the newsroom began to take shape was Alexis Scott, who joined the Atlanta Constitution in 1974. In 1928, Alexa Scott's family founded the Atlanta Daily World, a legacy that allowed her to see from both sides what Black Atlanta expected from the white press and what it still depended on the Black press to provide. Alexa Scott said that simply showing up mattered. It meant a great deal. People felt they could trust our reporting because they saw us as Black people working for the white press, Alexa Scott said. Although we saw ourselves as journalists who happened to be Black. Alexa Scott spent 23 years at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Cox Enterprises before retiring in 1997 to take over her family's business, the Atlanta Daily World. Others like Ernie Reese, who covered Black college sports, Ernie Holsendorf, who covered Black business, and Sheila Poole, who covered religion and stayed at the paper for 35 years, the longest tenure ever for a Black staffer, followed. Meanwhile, Tucker was making history of her own. In 1992, she became the first African-American editorial page editor of the Atlanta Constitution. She became editor of the combined editorial pages in 2001, emerging as one of the country's most prominent journalists and one of the most consequential figures in the paper's history. Tucker said her job was to take Ralph McGill's legacy and push it further, a charge she carried out with a sharp, fearless voice that helped to reorient the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's editorial stance on race, politics, and public life, even when it meant taking on Black politicians or the family of Martin Luther King, Jr. As a Black woman who grew up in the Deep South and who was working as an editorial page editor in the Deep South, it was easy to criticize racism. But I thought it was important for me to also challenge Black establishment figures who I believed had gone off course. It was important for me to say those things, Tucker said. It was easier to do that in Atlanta than it would have been in many other cities. Black Atlantans had achieved so much by the time I became editorial page editor that they didn't feel nearly as threatened as they might have in cities where less progress had been made. In 2007, largely because of her work writing about race and attacks on voting rights, Tucker earned a Pulitzer Prize for commentary, becoming the first and only African-American Atlanta Journal-Constitution staffer to win journalism's top prize. Following Tucker's example, by the 1990s and 2000s, the pipeline of Black reporters had strengthened as increased Black enrollment in journalism schools and changes in hiring practices brought more diversity into the field. That new generation would go on to shape the paper's modern coverage of civil rights, race, and Black culture, even as the paper experimented with structured race and identity beats. In the days after his appointment, Chapman set for an in-house interview with the staff of Unapologetically ATL, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's African-American-centered weekly newsletter. He said what, if anything, his leadership would change about the paper's coverage of Black life and Black issues. As a Black journalist, you carry a responsibility to bring the perspective of Black America into the newsroom. That's what inclusivity is, Chapman said. We want to understand needs, aspirations, obligations around opportunity, and outcomes. That conversation became an early signal of how Chapman intended to lead. Soon after, he approved the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's first full-length documentary, The South Got Something to Say, an Emmy-nominated exploration of Atlanta's hip-hop legacy. He also expanded Unapologetically ATL into a standalone franchise, now known as UATL, extending its reach beyond a weekly newsletter to community events, social media, video, and podcasting. If the future of local news is deep engagement and direct relationships with readers, we know there's a hunger for strong reporting on Black culture, HBCUs, and navigating Atlanta. UATL speaks to that ethic, Chapman said. It's reflective of who we are now and where we're going. Tucker, now retired and serving as a journalist in residence at the University of South Alabama, said her view of the paper's record comes with a caveat. We did better than many. Not perfect, but I'd give us a B+, she said. A lot of progress came because Black reporters and editors fought for it. Any newsroom legacy on race has to acknowledge that. For readers like Thomas Cochran, the end of the printed paper is not simply a technological shift, but the quiet loss of a daily ritual, and to a certain extent, a civic tool. Cochran, 77, a retired computer specialist and longtime Atlanta Journal-Constitution subscriber in Fairburn, Georgia, has spent decades cutting out articles, filing them, and carrying their lessons into his community work. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution gives me information I can use to inform our black community, he said. It's become my habit. I get up in the morning and I read my paper. Reading it on the phone just doesn't work for me. Going to the computer just doesn't feel the same. I miss being able to take the paper, sit on my deck or in my bed, and read it comfortably. That's a luxury. Earlier this month, Chapman found himself seated at the end of the fourth row at the Terra Theater. On stage were Ned Rarone and Nadja Parker, two original founders of Unapologetically ATL, joined by Deja Page and Brooke Lee Howard. The quartet serve as host of the UATL podcast, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's newest entry into the crowded audio landscape. More than 200 people, most of them black women, filled the theater to watch The Best Man Holiday. Listen as the host unpacks the film's themes and greet Chapman. Many had come not simply to consume journalism, but to experience it and to encounter the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in a more communal, participatory way than the printed page had ever allowed. It was a quiet but visual testament to how a newspaper, once encountered by readers like Cochran at breakfast tables, was now being met in theaters, conversations, and shared space. We've transformed from being just a daily newspaper into something broader. Podcasts, films, live events. Speaking to audiences in the ways they want to be reached, Chapman said. When I'm in rooms like that, my presence becomes part of the connection people feel to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I understand that desire for connection, and I'm proud we're able to meet it. I'm seeing the future. That was the article titled, "The Atlanta Journal-Constitution Confronts the Past and Looks to Its Future with Black Atlanta." This was written by Ernie Suggs and published Sunday, December 21st, 2025, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. That's all for this week. If you would like to replay this program or listen to past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them in the archives of the Audio Reader Service at the University of Kansas. That website is reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.